Once more unto the breach, dear friends, else fill up the wall with our English dead. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff McClure. Unfortunately, we don't have Jake with us today. He's off to Alberta on this November 15th. I guess he's what he's actually doing is going up to see in-laws and outlaws and things of that nature. Actually, in-laws, but sometimes the difference is minor. Telephone number's in here. If you'd like to discuss anything or ask questions to stimulate my poor, tired old brain, 773-1400 is the number if you're in East Bell County. Otherwise, 1-866-597-1400. Anywhere else here in the United States. And let's get started with what else is going on. I mentioned earlier that the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the Dow actually didn't quite finish out the week at a record. It hit a record on Thursday. The S&P 500 closed out the week again with a tiny gain, but another record. The NASDAQ continues to crawl towards its year 2000 record-setting level, which tells you a lot about where we are in the markets today, in the equity side of the market. In the equity side of the investment markets today, we are still below the NASDAQ, which is a big chunk of the market, is still below where it was in 2000. The S&P 500 and Dow are routinely setting records, but the records are, after adjustment for inflation, no higher than they were in 2000. So we are on the verge, we're teetering on the edge of coming out of the epic secular bear market that began in the year 2000. And I think the records will show continued through or into at least 2014. And next year, we're actually going to see a breakout, almost certainly, barring some totally unexpected event in the economy or in the world. We're actually going to see the stock market at a point, in all likelihood, where even after adjustment for inflation, it has recovered to the levels it experienced in 2000. And that, in the way I look at these things, is that type of recovery is the effective end of a secular bear market. And secular bear markets alternate with secular bull markets. It's just what we've seen in history. So the net result is we are about to cross the line, although you could argue that a secular bull began in 2009, and we certainly stated back in 2009 that we expected to see the stock market rise and break records again. And fortunately, and it is something to do probably as much with luck as with anything else, we did call pretty accurately the bottom of the market in 2009 on this radio program. And we also said that we would see huge gains going forward, and that that second bottom, and I say second bottom, the bottom in 2009 was the second bottom in this secular bear. The first one was in 2002. Secular bears tend to have two major bottoms, and the second one was in 2009. And as things began to recover, some people would say that was the beginning of a bull market. But we're right on the cusp of the new beginning, the point where the main market indices are now back up to the point where they were, where they started falling in 2000. The next leg, the next stage, historically over a long period of time, is a secular bull market. Now, the secular bull hasn't really gotten cranked up yet, and you can really tell this by the degree of worry and fear that's in the market. Bull markets do climb a wall of worry, and they die on exuberance. We're certainly not to the exuberance level yet, and won't be for some time. I'm going to guess, and this is just an educated guess, educated look at the future, is sometime about 15 years from now, between 10 and 15 years from now, the secular bull will end and we'll go back into a secular bear. And why do I say that? That's not because I have some deep economic knowledge or insight that other people don't have. I've just looked at history, and we tend to run in these cycles. Sometime 20, 30, plus or minus 5 years, which is a big chunk of time, we're going to see us convert from a secular bull. By the way, at the end of the secular bull, we'll have people saying this could go on forever, and it's different this time, and there's no need to worry about a bear market. Once that pervasive opinion settles into the marketplace, we're due for a big fall. Meanwhile, folks, we are in a secular bull, and the thing about a secular bull is ride it out. Don't try to fight it. Don't try to analyze it. Just like in a secular bear, you need to treat it like it's a bear. Most people won't, and there's a lot of people still very much afraid right now, and they are keeping money out of the market. Very similar to the way people are behaving with their own personal money. They're not spending it. They tend to save it and hoard it. And as a result, the economy is running relatively slowly, and that probably won't fix itself for another, probably 2016, before it really gets well in that area, because it takes time. It takes some really serious time. Now, in between, we're going to have short-term cyclical bears. We're going to have panics in the market. And so there's a strategy. I was talking about some of the big stuff last hour, talking about some of the little stuff, the crucial stuff this hour. And one of the things that's crucial is to look at your portfolio, your investments, and there's some basic science to it. I'm going to give away some free information here that's worth every penny you paid for it, but that I've spent over 30 years learning. And that is that a secular bear or secular bull is what it is, but the short-term panics can occur at any time. October is the most likely month for them to occur, but they don't just occur in October. They occur just because they occur. Sometimes they occur without even a reason. And we can get a 30% drop in the market, and we can get it in a very short period of time. And as you transition, now if you're in the accumulation stage in your investment portfolio where you're putting money away, you should jump for joy when the market takes a nosedive. Obviously, most people don't. They bail out of the market at that point, and they miss a great opportunity. But if you're in the accumulation stage and you're putting money away in your 401k or something and the market drops suddenly, if you can find any way to put more money in there, do it. Here's the catcher, though. A lot of people, the boomers, are retiring. Once you've entered into retirement, the reverse is true. When the market takes a sudden nosedive, you need to have a plan of action to deal with that, because the average, if you have a well-diversified portfolio, and unfortunately a lot of people don't, they have some unduly concentrated portfolios, even though they think they're diversified, and I've certainly seen a lot of that. The market takes a sudden nosedive, a panic, and they just continue to draw money out of their panicked fund, or they make a worse decision, which is to shift over into cash out of fear. The problem with shifting to cash out of fear is not when do you get back in. And believe me, I've watched people devastate their investment portfolios over my 32-year career so far. I've watched them bail out of the market when the market starts down, sometimes using market timing, sometimes just because they were afraid. And the market, the day after they bail out, suddenly shoot upward. So they lost 10, 20% before they got out. And then it shot up, and that 10 to 20% loss is made permanent, because when they get back in, the market is already up. So they bought high, sold low, and then bought high again. This has a devastating effect on an investment portfolio, and I've just seen it happen far too often. So what do you do? And here's my recommendation. First off, it's crucial that you invest according to asset classes, not according to what you think is hot. Very frankly, if you were smart enough to guess what you should invest in the market specifically to beat everybody else, you could easily be earning seven figures a year at a mutual fund. But since us normal mortal people, including myself, are not smart enough, don't have, and I shouldn't say not smart enough, we don't have an army of researchers to ferret out information that potentially could give you an edge over other investors. I mean, we just don't have that. And so since we don't have that, we have to operate off some certain principles that are pretty consistent, that are very consistent in the market. One of them is the market goes up and down. And the higher the return you expect in your investment portfolio, the more up and down movement you're going to get. This is called variance or standard deviation or whatever you want to call it, but the bottom line are market risk. And the higher the return you want out of your portfolio, the higher the variance you will see over time, both up and down, but don't be fooled by either one. And I can tell you that the ups and down movements of the market, the major moves of the market, up and down, are so random that nobody has ever been able to effectively predict them. And that means it's probably a bad idea to try. So what do you do? As I said, if you're in the accumulation phase, you're relatively young, you're a long ways from retirement, and you want to just, then you just keep investing and find some way to invest more when the market's down. But once you retire, there's a strategy, which we use at the Personal Wealth Coach, that historically has proven to be very, very good. If you have a very well-diversified portfolio, and by the way, an S&P 500 stock index fund is not a well-diversified portfolio. If you have an asset class diversified portfolio focused in value stocks, this is what has done the best historically. Mid-cap value as an asset class is the best overall asset class in equities, although there's some others that can help it along and make it perform, make the portfolio perform better. But if you have value stocks and they're in the mid-cap range, and let's just say that you did that, that's an asset class, and you have maybe some real estate in there or some diversified emerging markets, which are other good long-term investments but shouldn't be the core, and the market takes a nosedive while you are doing systematic withdrawals, what's your plan? Unfortunately, most people don't have a plan there. And they react to it when it happens, which is a bad thing to do. My recommendation is, first off, you should have money in the conservative allocation funds, which will dip with the market in a panic, but will come back typically fairly quickly. You should have a significant amount of your money in there. Not all of it, but that should be your core position. Secondly, you need to have about 18 months of dry powder. Now, what I mean by dry powder, that means if we had a 1987 market panic, and we can use that one as the model, 18 months later, the market had recovered. Now, what caused the 1987 market panic? To this day, there are debates over that. Nobody knows. They just happen, and I tend to think it's simply chaos occurring. It's simply the nature of the way markets and animal populations and people and birds fly and everything else. There's something called chaos out there, and it just happens. When do those things happen? They happen when they happen. They tend to happen more often in October, but they still can happen at any time. And it's kind of like if you lived in California being prepared for an earthquake, because earthquakes happen in California, and if you're not prepared for one, you are playing Russian roulette. The same thing is true with market panics. Could we get a market panic at any time? Sure. Very frankly, if somebody assassinated the president, we'd have a market panic. I certainly hope nobody assassinates the president, but it's happened in the past. There's a lot of things. Somebody could set off a dirty bomb in New York City, we'd have a market panic. If you'll recall, we had a pretty good market panic after 9/11, could we have another equivalent of a 9/11? We sure could. A lot of efforts being put into stopping that, and it's been successful so far, but it could happen. It's like if you lived on the coast in Texas or anywhere else in the eastern or southern United States, you should be thoroughly prepared for a hurricane. If you live in California or anywhere up and down the West Coast, you should be thoroughly prepared for a major earthquake. And if any part of your livelihood has to do with being in the stock market, being invested, you should be prepared for a market panic because they actually do happen. So what do? My recommendation is to have 18 months of short-term bonds and cash always available in your portfolio so that in the event of a market panic, and you say, okay, how do I know when there's a market panic? Well, it's really not that hard. In the event of a market panic, simply take your monthly withdrawals and direct them to the dry powder side of your portfolio. So if you're taking $1,000 a month out of your portfolio to supplement your other sources of income, and I'm using this just as a generic figure, you should have $18,000 of either cash or a high-grade short-term bond fund. And I'll just tell you up front, the key is to look for the quality of the underlying investments and the cost. You want to have an underlying bond fund that has the lowest cost you can find with high quality. I mean, that's just common sense about anything else, but for some reason or another, people tend to flock to high-cost bond funds, and they tend to flock to them mainly because they pay high commissions and brokers sell them. And so brokers do not like to offer you extremely low-cost bond funds because, frankly, one of the reasons behind the low cost is they don't pay commissions. And if they don't pay commissions and they don't pay for the broker's trip, annual trip to Acapulco or wherever he goes with his girlfriend or his wife or whatever, he's not going to offer it to you. And by the way, brokers today are called financial advisors, which is a horrible misnomer. And I could get off on that one, too. By the way, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. It's November 15th. Telephone number's in here, 773-1400 or 1-866-597-1400. There are several articles this week came out about people who have suddenly had a violent conversion to being advocates for using a independent investment advisor over a brokerage firm. And there's some really good reasons for that. There's a serious problem with this month that was Massachusetts began investigating of Capital Securities non-traded REIT sales. Really, it's called Realty Capital Securities. All of a sudden, Linsco, Private Ledger, Fidelity, and a host of other people stopped selling them. And the reason... there's a couple of interesting things in there. American Realty Capital Properties Incorporated and other similar, well, that's a publicly traded one, but the ones that are particularly privately traded, in other words, they're not carried, they're called alternative investments. And by the way, alternative investments by definition scare the heck out of me. What do alternative investments have in common? They theoretically cause your portfolio to be more stable because the price doesn't vary very much. Well, the reason the price doesn't vary very much is because they're not on the open market for people to buy and sell. Therefore, the owners, the people who sponsor these things, can set the price artificially. Even when they're losing money, they can say they can keep the price up. So it looks good on your statement, and it doesn't look like you're losing money when, in fact, you're losing money hand over fist. If you ever try to liquidate it, that's when you find out whether you've gained or lost. And unfortunately, in many cases, when people go to liquidate these things, there's not much there to liquidate. The sponsor and the broker made a lot of money, but the person who bought into it, you, the investment holder, lost a lot of money, and that's typical. Now, why? Having been a broker, I was a broker for 25 years, and I can tell you that these non-traded alternative investments inevitably pay absolutely the highest of possible commissions. The highest of possible point or whatever it is that the brokerage firm gives the broker, the financial advisor, number of points to go on, quote, convention trips or educational trips to exotic places and five-star resorts. This is normal behavior among financial advisors. Are all financial advisors like this? No. There are a few who are striving day in and day out to be as honest as they can. They generally do provide a good service. Unfortunately, the top producers, and if you see a lot of awards for top production in the office of a financial advisor, you can say this is one of those guys whose objective is to make the most money. And that's economically normal, for whatever it's worth. I mean, if you think about the issue that if you're working somewhere and you could get paid $100,000 a year, you could get paid $50,000 a year, most people would opt for the $100,000. Well, opting for the $100,000 means selling alternative investments and high commissioned investments, which by definition have higher internal expenses, much higher internal expenses, in order to pay the financial advisor and the financial advisor's brokerage firm. So that money comes out of your money. And I told you a moment ago, it's important to have a short-term bond fund in there to gain a little interest, but it has to be a really high-quality bond fund with a really low expense ratio. The really low expense ratio means that the financial advisor doesn't get a commission. And if they don't get a commission, odds are they're not going to sell it. So that's just the reality of the marketplace out there. On the other hand, if you go to an investment advisory firm, one that is not affiliated or associated with a brokerage firm. Now, everybody's got to use some kind of brokerage firm. Our firm uses several. We use Pershing and some others as custodians. But it's very important that they use an independent custodian. But the firm that we use to do that pays no commissions to us, pays nothing to us. And so our objective, and the objective of any independent registered investment advisory firm, and I want to emphasize this, independent firm registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission, because a person can have no experience and very tiny amount of money under management registered with the state of Texas. By the time a firm gets registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission, they must have at least $100 million under management, which means they've got a big enough operation that they need to be doing it right. And so if you go to a firm that's registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission and is independent, it's just a matter of between good and better. If you go to a brokerage firm, even if the financial advisor, anyone who calls themselves a financial advisor, by the way, as their title, should be suspect immediately. My recommendation is that you go to a firm that has at least one member if you really are interested in having a portfolio well managed. You should use a firm that has at least one member, leading member or something, that's a member of the National Association of Professional Financial Advisors. And I know I just used that term. It's a term that they had long before it was co-opted by people who sell things. Because they have an oath that they will not have a conflict of interest and that they will not be paid under the table or over the table or anywhere else by the people you invest with. That's a crucial element. If you are approaching retirement or you're in retirement, it is really, really, really a critical thing for you to, if you're going to use a professional to assist you, which I would recommend in most cases, unless you just have lots of money and don't need a very high return, that you use an independent investment advisory firm where the member, at least one member of that firm, is a member of NAPFA. Because that, basically, if a person says, I'm not a member of NAPFA, but I'm an independent investment advisor, and their odds are they have some conflict of interest, and there's no certainty here, but they have some conflict of interest there, disclosed or undisclosed, that would preclude them from being a member of this fee-only organization that has a phenomenal reputation. How many of those are there in the United States? There's about 1,600 of them, that's all. And yes, big corporations are not normally members of NAMFA. Big corporations also normally have conflicts of interest when they're managing your investment portfolio, even if they are an investment advisor. Their conflict of interest run pretty deep and pretty wide. And this all came about because there are several non-traded alternative investments, as well as, of course, hedge funds, which in many cases are used as alternative investments, that have turned up to be quite fraudulent and have sort of blown up, and each of them is associated typically with a major broker-dealer somehow. And those major broker-dealers then get sued and cough up anywhere from tens to hundreds of millions of dollars, but then they just continue on about their very high-profit business. And how do you know if you're involved in something like that? The answer is you don't till it blows up. On the other hand, if you use an organization that acknowledges its fiduciary responsibility to you right from the beginning in writing, the odds of that happening fall off rather dramatically. And as you notice, I said an organization, not a standalone. A standalone investment advisor is a high risk in and of itself. That's a high risk operation in and of itself, because that person typically doesn't have a compliance officer, doesn't have a staff, and if something happens to them, you're lost. The other thing is that I would advise using against you, not using even an investment advisor that is embedded in another firm in any form or fashion, whether it's a brokerage firm or an accounting firm or a law firm or whatever. There again is a fundamental conflict of interest in that. It may be acceptable to you, and that may be fine, but in most cases, what you have under those circumstances is somebody whose primary profession is one thing, who's doing a little investment advising on the side. And it's kind of my soapbox for today. I was counseled recently that we, who are fiduciary investment advisors, fee-only fiduciary investment advisors, tend to be far too reticent in blowing our horns because the brokerage firms are out there. And one of the things that brought this up, the SEC, excuse me, was tasked years ago with coming up with a decision on a fiduciary standard for the brokerage industry. The people in the brokerage industry, the financial advisors who claim to be giving financial and investment advice, but in fact are employees of a corporation that charges, that pays commissions for selling things. There's such a huge conflict there. And the SEC has delayed again and is undecided on, quote, a fiduciary standard for people like for financial advisors. And there's a big signal in that headline, and the big signal in the headline is that financial advisors working for brokerage firms, even if they claim to be on the investment advisory side of the brokerage firm, are not held to a fiduciary standard. And what's a fiduciary standard? A fiduciary standard is very simply that the person will clearly show any conflicts of interest to you and clearly, at all times, work in your best interest. And if you can't understand what they present you, and there's pretty, and I'm just going to say, if they're working with a brokerage firm at the same time they're being an investment advisor, if you have a very significant amount of money, then you may be in the wrong place. I also want to emphasize that brokers have a role. If you want to buy and sell stuff, and you want somebody to give you advice on that and give you information on that, then the broker who is earning a commission every time you buy something or sell something may be the best route for you. It's kind of like going to Vegas. You don't expect the people in Vegas to be operating in your best interest, but that's the only place you can legally gamble. So it is literally you can go to other places, but when you go to a casino, you don't really expect them to be operating in your best interest. Their mission is to take your money and give you a little back, and they do a pretty good job of that. As long as you understand that, that's fine. And if you think you can beat the system, you're welcome to go try to beat the system. It's great entertainment, and a lot of people do that. And again, I want to emphasize there are some people out there in the brokerage industry who are trying to do a good job. I can also tell you from experience on both sides of this fence that if a person really were serious in operating in your best interest as their number one priority, they'll be an investment advisor. The difficulty is because of the low costs an investment advisor charges, it's often very, very difficult to find an investment advisor if you don't have a significant amount of money. Typically, around $500,000 is where you can find reliable investment advisors. $750,000, you probably should not have too much difficulty. And at $1 million, there's absolutely no question but that you should be using a qualified, independent, fee-only investment advisory firm that does not either sell stuff for commissions or have anything to do with it, with commissions and the conflict of interest involved there. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and we need to do a break for commercials. And the telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or 1-866-597-1400. And we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff McClure. Jake's out of town up in Alberta experiencing the cold and the snow. Telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or 1-866-597-1400. And as we discussed, the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 spent the week breaking records again. The NASDAQ is crawling back up towards finally breaking the record it set in 2000. About 9% more in the NASDAQ, which we could easily get this year. And it will be back up there. We're pretty much set up for a Santa Claus rally. And I'd kind of be surprised to not see it happen this year. Barring some unexpected event, probably the next 6 months we'll see the market up significantly. Another major trend historically, and there's only one exception to it that I've seen in looking back, all the way back in history, is that following midterm elections, when Congress is held by one party and the other party holds the White House, you have a great two-year market run. Anywhere from, I think, a worst-case scenario in the upper double digits per year, upper single digits, I mean, per year, all the way up to an average of 15% a year over the next 2 years. This is one of those trends that is, as I said, it's unbroken in history. We had a bit of an, if you just look at midterm elections, it doesn't always hold true with midterm elections, but it does hold true in a midterm election where one party holds Congress and the president's seat, the White House, is held by a different party. And this goes all the way back as far as we have records, the beginning of the 20th century, late 19th century. Again, that's one of those things that nobody really, there's a lot of hypothesis as to why it works that way. But the fact that it does work that way is a given. Now, that doesn't mean there can't be dips along the way. It doesn't mean there can't be bumps and grinds along the way. But the typical thing that we would expect to see in this environment is a mid-level double-digit return 2 years in a row in the S&P 500 stock index, or the Dow for that matter, as we move into next year. Does that mean you should invest 100% of your money in equities? Not if you're not a big risk taker, because but that does mean that there's really not a lot to be afraid of in the immediate future, not despite the fact that there's a great deal of fear in the air and in the atmosphere. Well, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. Again, telephone number 773-1400 or 1-866-597-1400. And my voice is getting a little hoarse after talking for 2 hours, but as we come up on 2 hours. The probabilities are, by the way, that we're going to continue to see a fall in oil prices and a fall in the cost of gasoline, which has its pluses and its minuses, mostly the pluses for the people in the United States economy, because it puts more money in our pockets, and if we'll go out and spend it, it'll possibly kick things into a little higher gear. Which brings me to an interesting point. Microsoft rose last week into the second largest capitalized, as far as capital, the total value of all the stock, the second largest company in the world, edging out Exxon, whose stock is slipping because of the falling cost of oil. And I was kind of surprised, even though I do tend to keep up with this, I tend to forget it, what the largest, the highest capital company, the highest capitalized company in the world is, and by far, and more to find out how relatively cheap the stock is. And I'm not saying that you should go out and buy it, but the largest company in the world, if we count its stock price as the size of the company, which is probably, in other words, we add up all the shares outstanding and we add them together, largest company in the world is Apple. And that is always a surprise to me, even though I've seen it probably hundreds of times. But it tells you something about where our economy is going right now. There was a time when Procter & Gamble was the largest company. There's other times when automobile companies have been the largest companies. There was a time when General Motors was the largest company. There was a time when General Electric was the largest company. And the fact that Apple has the highest capitalization, the largest amount of money invested in it, is today the largest company, not only in the United States, but in the world, is a bit of a shock. Until you realize the phenomenal change that Apple has wrought and is making in our society. It's still happening. Apple Pay has got 200,000 stores now participating in it. It's got about half a dozen major credit card companies participating in it. And while I hate to break this, I hate to be an advocate for any company, I'm going to tell you that it looks to me like Apple Pay is going to dominate the retail market within a very few years, in the same way that Amazon has come to dominate other aspects of the retail market. And I know that Amazon is kicking themselves, or whoever, the people at Amazon, the executives, are kicking themselves right now because they didn't think of this. And I just read an article in the Wall Street Journal where a person got their Apple 6, their iPhone 6, rather, and with its fingerprint recognition, and went out and used the Apple Pay app and found it to be phenomenally easy and preferable over any other method of payment she'd ever heard of. And what it takes is your fingerprint. In other words, your finger has to go on the button to activate it. And once you've looked at the number and you approve it with your fingerprint, by simply putting your finger on the button, you pass the phone near a receptor and it pays your bill. And it's charged wherever you've told it to charge. It can charge your bank account. It can charge your credit card, a debit card, however you want to handle it. You can charge it that way. And the point is that the writer of the article in the Wall Street Journal made, and I completely agree with this, is she doesn't have to fish around for change. The person on the other side of the counter doesn't have to make change. It is so simple, and there is a record of it, and it is completely, as far as anyone has been able to tell so far, secure. This says something about our economy. We are in the business of creating new ideas and putting them into work, and the rest of the world adopts them. And I think that this is a prime example. I happen to have an iPhone 6 Plus and have fallen in love with it. Think it's the greatest thing I've ever owned, electronically at least. It is so useful. It replaces my computer sometimes. It certainly replaces my iPad much of the time. And it is so much more useful than a regular iPhone that I am astonished. And so that says something about our economy, that we're the people who are innovating and creating these new ideas and bringing us into the future, and the rest of the world is following. And as I mentioned earlier, Europe is teetering on the verge of slipping back into deflation and recession. Japan is struggling mightily to pull out of a 14-year recession. China is struggling trying to keep their growth up to the point where they can keep everybody employed. And the United States is developing new technologies and breaking new ground, which should make you very, very happy to be living in the United States of America. Well, my name is Jeff McClure. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. We have some more commercials to play, so we're going to play some more commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff McClure. Telephone numbers in here are 773-1400 or 1-866-597-1400. And I'm getting a little bit hoarse after talking for a couple of hours to this phone ball. We've got about 5 minutes left in today's show on this November 15th, year of our Lord, 2014. At least that's what it appears from here. And there's a couple of things at the tail end here that's worthy of note. One of them is that the deficit is coming under control very nicely. It won't stay that way unless we can fix Social Security and Medicare. And I think we may very well do those things. For whatever it's worth, in the last couple of years, there have been some strong indications of bipartisan activity in Congress. And I think it's entirely possible that we could get bipartisan activity in Congress in this last 2 years. The question is whether the president will attempt to veto, and I think if he does, his own party will beat him up, because basically I think a lot of folks would like to be seen going into the 2016 presidential elections. A lot of people in Congress want to be seen as effective governors, effective government creators in Congress. The only organization, the only political entity in the United States less popular than the president right now is Congress. It's about half the popularity of the president. And I think there's a lot of people in Congress who would like to run for president, so they would like to see some movement on a series of things. And I think we may actually get some movement on a series of things in the next couple of years, contrary to popular belief. I'm kind of optimistic about it. Also tell you that there's a very high probability that our next president will be Hillary Clinton. And whether I'm for that or against it is totally beside the point. The issue is it's just a probability at this point. Not a certainty, but a probability. And I can also tell you that if Hillary Clinton is elected as president in 2016, we will probably have an excellent market for the next 4 to 8 years for those of you interested in investing in the market. That's going to infuriate a lot of people. But it's just one of those things where my job is to look at the objective, to the best of my ability, objective reality of what's going on out there. Why do I say these things? And I've been asked that on many occasions. Why do I say these unpopular things that, by the way, almost inevitably turn out to be the future? It's because I read a lot of books. And the books specifically that I like are the ones written in the late 1900s. Which sounds like a long time ago now, the late 20th century, and forecast what was going to happen and have been correct. And believe it or not, things are unfolding right now, almost precisely the way Douglas North wrote in 1978, the way that Strauss and Howe wrote, and the way that David Hackett Fisher wrote, things would unfold. And they're happening so well and so consistently, I have to say they're probably going to be right into the future. We got a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. We only got a couple of minutes left. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll make it quick, Jeff. I just want to tell you what a great show it's been up until you said that Hillary Clinton will be our next president.
Well, again, it's kind of like saying winter's going to come and it's going to be cold, and summer's going to come and it's going to be hot. Yeah, I don't like hot weather.
I agree with you, but I'm afraid that might happen too.
And by the way, I don't think she'll be a bad president. I think she'll be very much like Bill Clinton was. I know we look back on Bill Clinton. He's a Democrat. He did some things maybe you didn't like or I didn't like, but by and large, as an economy, and as those who invest in the market saw, we really were better off after 8 years of Bill Clinton. And I hate to say this, but I mean, even though I philosophically may disagree with her, remember the presidents tend to do the opposite of what you elect them to do. George W. Bush came here and said, let's not get involved in a ground war in Asia where we have a police action, where we're trying to build nations and fight a counterinsurgency. I heard him say that right here in Central Texas when he was governor. And then he did it. Bill Clinton was elected by the unions and pushed through NAFTA. Anyway, thanks for calling.
The reason I called, I want to say that I listen to your show every Saturday. I get tuned in late sometime. Today I didn't get tuned in about 11:15. But for the next 20, 25 minutes, you had the best, most informative program of any financial program on the air.
Well, thank you.
I listen to them all. I listen to CapStar out of Austin, Reed Financial, Ken Murray, the Mutual Fund Store, all of them. And
thank you.
All, after listening to what you said, they all really seem self-serving.
But we're out of time, so thank you very much.
Well, enjoy the program.
All right. And this has been the Personal Wealth Coach. You're welcome to
your Fox News
give us a call at 947-1111. We have a voicemail. And at 1-800-914-PLAN. And you can contact me at jeff@tpwc.com. We'll be back next week with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.